They didn't bring pitchforks, but they brought their pen and they were ready to sign up with their checkbooks and they said, bring it on, we want this now.
This is episode 274 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'm Lisa Gonzalez. Public Utility District 3 in Mason County, Washington, delivers symmetrical gigabit connectivity to every customer in its service area. They have no speed, capacity, or data thresholds. You have access to a gigabit regardless of whether you're in a rural area or within city limits, and whether or not you're a household, business, or one of the ISPs that work with PUD3. This week, Justin Holsgrove and Joel Meyer from PUD3 in Mason County spend some time talking with Christopher about how the Public Utility District is working to bring high-quality connectivity to each customer. In addition to describing their plan to build out and manage the network, Justin and Joel share the story of how connectivity has come to be offered from PUDs in Washington. Now here's Christopher with Justin Holsgrove and Joel Meyer talking about Public Utility District 3 in Mason County, Washington.
Welcome to another edition of the Community Broadband Bits podcast. I'm Chris Mitchell at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance up in Minneapolis. And today I'm speaking with Justin Holsgrove, the Telecommunications and Community Relations Manager up at Mason County's Public Utility District Number 3. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. I'm excited to learn more about what you're doing. But first, I have to introduce our other guest, Joel Meyer, the Public Information and Government Relations Manager at PUD Number 3. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a beautiful day in the fiberhood.
That's good. Joel, I'd like to start with you. And can you just tell us a little bit about maybe Mason County, how it's situated, and a little bit of the background of the Public Utility District?
Sure. Mason PUD3 is located on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State. The main city in our service territory is the city of Shelton. And the county has about 60-some-odd thousand residents, and it's relatively defined by natural resources, including forest and aquaculture. We have a large number of seasonal customers that we serve for Mason County PUD number 3. About 25% of our customers, as a matter of fact, are seasonal. They come here for the beautiful views, the water, and the forests. But we have approximately 34,000 customers that we serve with electricity. But we also, of course, as is the focus of this interview, have a fiber optic network that supports our network and also provides services via wholesale to customers throughout. But in terms of the history of PUD3, it's an interesting, rocky start. But I think that it has proved for the customers of Mason County a real benefit. The Washington State Grange back in the 1920s was very upset that there wasn't enough electricity being brought out to rural areas of Washington State. And if it was brought out by the companies that provide electricity at that time, it was brought out at extremely high cost and high rates. So in the 1920s, the Grange started a petition drive in Washington State, and Washington State's initiative number one, the very first one that was brought to the legislature in the state's history, to form public utility districts for electricity and a number of other services that are outlined in the state law. It got onto the ballot and was overwhelmingly approved. Mason County PUD number 3 and its partner were the only county in Washington State that has two operating public utility districts within its boundaries, PUD 1. PUD 1 started service in 1934. PUD 3 had to go through a long list of legal challenges until in 1939. We were authorized by the state Supreme Court to start serving customers. And our first customer base was 8 customers. And that's grown over the years as it's gone forth. But PUD 3's public utility districts in general, and Mason PUD 3 in particular, has always had kind of the long view. What do our customers need to be successful in either their home life or in their businesses? How can we provide better service to do that? And we've just slowly grown our system's benefits and its capabilities to meet that. And in the late 1990s, we started looking at using a fiber optic network to support our facilities. And in 2000, the state legislature authorized us the authority to sell wholesale. But Justin has a lot more information on how we went from there.
Yeah, I think it's a really great story when we talk about the origins of public utility districts, how they were formed for the very purpose of bringing a required utility and a necessary utility or an essential utility to the rural communities. In that case, it was electricity. We take that for granted now. But today, we're looking at that as high-speed broadband as an essential utility. And we're working as a public utility to bring high-speed broadband to communities that are in the rural setting, rural context that don't have other options for high-speed internet. And we see a lot of parallels between the electrification of rural Mason County or rural America, if you will, and the high-speed broadband infrastructure being put into rural America. And we're happy to continue our legacy to help support our customers in that way.
And Justin, I get a sense that with the utility district, the fiber was probably built first to support actual infrastructure, probably electricity, water services maybe, but the infrastructure that you're already doing.
Yes, absolutely. That's correct. So the primary goal of our fiber optic network is to support, as you said, electrical infrastructure. That means we network our facilities in the field, such as substations or reclosers, regulators, different offices. We have several communications towers throughout Mason County that we have a fiber backbone to, and these support things like our grid modernization project, our advanced metering infrastructure, and our radio system so that our crews can communicate to each other and operate the system. So we do have a very extensive fiber network throughout Mason County, but it is primarily backbone. And part of our history on that is when we first started putting this up, there was great interest from some of the larger customers as well. As we were putting this up, you know, they had a real need for higher bandwidth services. And so as we expanded for electrical needs, we also were able to pick up a couple of our larger customers. We had goals of picking up our top 20, and then it grew to top 50 customers. We brought our fiber network to areas such as our port districts and throughout our downtown districts. But when it gets into the rural communities, what we found ourselves in is that we didn't have a plan to have a long-term expansion and a long-term plan to serve all customers in a neighborhood, if you will. And so we had to really solve that problem.
Well, and this is something that I actually in some ways sympathize, I suspect, with you, Joel, in that I've seen where residents can get quite forceful about really wanting to see the utility district be more aggressive in building out fiber, whereas and you might find other people are equally aggressive about the public utility district not doing it. So I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about that. And I think there maybe things came to a head a bit in 2015 for you.
That's a very good point, because over the years, and I think that we became somewhat the victim of our success on the electric side and the expectations of what we could provide on the broadband side. For example, over the years that we have had the authority from the state legislature to provide wholesale telecommunications, we have heard long, loud, and often from many of our customers that not only do they want broadband that in their areas, they want PUD3 broadband because their expectation is that our service would be as good, if not better, than our electric side, which brings the discussion of the wholesale versus retail relationship that we can have with our customers. But I would say that on our list right now of our 34,000 customers, we have a continuous list of about 4,000 residents, customers that are clamoring for it in their neighborhood. Some, they just don't have service. Some, they don't like the service they have because it's either too expensive or too slow or not reliable. And then they look at us and say, well, you're always reliable with your electricity and your prices are pretty good. Why don't you work to get it out to us so that we can have the same type of quality for our broadband? And the big balance is that wholesale retail relationship that kind of holds us back, but also provides opportunities for local economic development through the formation of businesses that can be that retailer for us.
Yeah, and Justin, I'd like to get a little bit of your perspective on this with how you are expanding the fiber network to some of these residents, what that plan is. But maybe we can just start by where Joel left off. I looked at your website, and there's several companies that are offering very high-speed services. So how exactly is that working out for you?
I think it works out well, and it works out better for our customers when we have a selection of retailers for them to choose from. As we know, competition brings price down and brings the best out of everybody, whether it's sports or in business. And as we've had more retailers join our network and offer their services to our customers are benefiting. They're benefiting by faster speeds and lower prices. And that's one of the things that we really like about our network. It's open access, non-discriminatory. So our customers can choose any of the retailers that are partners with us. And that's a real big win.
Justin, let me ask you this, because one of the criticism we've heard sometimes in theory, sometimes in practice, is that in an open access environment like you have, in which there's actually a fair level playing field, inevitably one or two firms capture most of the market anyway. Is that something you see, or the distribution of subscribers split a little more evenly among the service providers?
We have several, a handful of service providers. They all are participating, from my perspective, at a level that suits their business desire. So we have one service provider that, you know, maybe isn't so much interested in growing their business. Their desire is to focus on the handful of customers that they have, and they're doing well with that. We have another business retail service provider that's been there since the beginning, and they have, you know, the majority of the customers because they have a more robust name and the history there. And we have one who's a little bit newer, and you know, they're doing a really good job of being competitive and doing a lot of marketing and advertising about the benefits of fiber all the way to the home. And so they're, as we expand the network, are picking up their, you know, their share of customers as well. So it seems to work out really well for us. We also have two providers that are focusing on business or enterprise services, and that's a really good niche for them. And that's working out well for them as well. They aren't interested in doing residential, and you know, in some cases, not the other way, vice versa. So it seems to work out well.
Right. I think it's a really good perspective. A reminder that even if a business isn't capturing a massive part of the market, that they might be fine with that. So it's a good reminder. So how are you expanding the network given all this incredible demand to go further with it?
Yeah, well, Chris, I want to go back a little bit to that 2015 kind of point that we ran into, and I think that's a good place to tell the story of where we sort of pivoted with our network. We have expanded the network to most of, not all of, but most of the areas where we need it for the electrical distribution system. While that's always growing, Mason County is a defined area, and we're pretty well spread throughout there. We've also worked with NoNet, and we've established several cell phone contracts with cell phone towers, and you know, they have paid to expand the network to some areas as well. So we have a pretty wide spread of backbone.
NoNet, for those who haven't run across it, is the Northwest Open Access Network. And let me strongly encourage you, if you're unfamiliar with it, to go back in our archives a little bit. We've done several interviews with them. So, Justin, please pick up with how you're expanding it beyond the electrical and where it was in 2015.
So in 2015, we really were making a pivot or beginning to make a pivot with our philosophy on how we approached the expansion of our fiber network. As you know, we've talked about this. We're able to sell the excess capacity on our network. And with fiber in today's optics and electronics, that is near limitless. And the only thing that we were limited by were the actual physical connections, the physical strands of fiber. So we were just really working hard to try to figure out, well, what's our philosophy? What are our construction standards? How are we going to engineer and design this? We're a bunch of electric utility folks, not so much telecom folks. And with electricity, it's easy. You find the wire and you cut it back and you put a hot clamp on it, and there you go. But as you know, with fiber, it's a little bit different. And so as we were exploring on the construction side on how to do this, we were really getting a lot of pressure and interest from our customers to expand fiber to them. Everybody wants it, and they want it now. And so we had a high-speed broadband expo where we invited all customers in. We focused on several areas that were rural, focused on several areas where we thought there may be some possibilities of doing some pilot project expansions. We had over 800 people join us on a Thursday evening, I believe it was, in May of 2015.
That's and crazy.
They didn't bring pitchforks, but they brought their pen and they were ready to sign up with their checkbooks. And they said, bring it on. We want this now.
When 100 people show up at a meeting on a Thursday night, that's considered huge. 800 is off the charts. So congratulations and you know, I guess caution.
But yeah, you know, I think you're on it there. I don't know that we were so wise with this. It was all part of the process, and the process was necessary. But you know, we had 800 people ready to sign up right now, and that was a big deal. We had a place for them to share their interests, record their address. We had this thing where you could stick a dot on your home location in Mason County, and so we have this this large poster sized chart of Mason County that looks like it has the chicken pox because everybody wants it all over the place. And so, you know, we had a bunch of stations that could meet our retailers, the active ones that are on our network, ones that are interested in expanding, see their services. And really, it was a positive step because it made a very clear, it made our customers' interests very clear. They want to see the fiber network expanded. And unfortunately, you know, you mentioned caution. We have this term that we sort of developed around that time called anticipointment. And this is where people are anticipating something but are disappointed when they can't get it. And that really sort of became the theme of our fiber network, unfortunately. That was never, you know, the intention, but that kind of became a reality. So we went from 2015, from that big kind of landmark event, to really needing to buckle down and get our construction standards figured out. So we tried several different, we had been working on several different, you know, distribution models, and we were able to identify a couple of ways that we wanted to go about it. We moved into a distribution hut and an RC terminal, ready to connect a terminal model for our neighborhoods, and we focus on areas where there are where there's overhead power or where there's conduit available. And so we built a couple of networks in several of the more densely populated, and I put that in quotation, areas in rural Mason County where they didn't have any other access to high-speed broadband available. So we built these networks, and we're able to work out some kinks with our process and really establish some really good construction and engineering standards, and establish some cost measurables so that we could move forward and look and see what it would take to really roll this out much, much broader. And so while we were doing that, we also did a survey. And we did a survey with our customers, this past winter, 2016 to 2017. We did a statistically valid phone survey. So asked several questions such as, you know, what kind of broadband do you have now? You know, so we can measure the need. And then we wanted to measure the desire. Are you interested in seeing the PUD expand? And then we also asked, if we expand, are you interested in paying a little more per month on your broadband bill to pay for the cost of the expansion? And the overwhelming answers were, no, we don't have broadband access, or we're not satisfied with it. And yes, we want PUD to build it. And yes, we're willing to pay extra. So that was the part of serving our customers with that statistically valid phone survey. And then several months later, we did an online survey so that we could give everybody the opportunity to respond if they wanted. We also had a mail-in ballot as well, if you will. And the results were pretty consistent across the board.
And Joel, I'd like to bring you back into this. One of the things we've seen with surveys in some of the other public utility districts is a question of whether they want to modestly increase the price of electricity to help finance the cost of the fiber. And it sounds like you're actually focused on making sure the broadband customers alone are the ones paying for the expansion. I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about your thinking about that.
We've seen this question come up again and again at other utilities in Washington State as to whether or not customers, A, want it, B, would be willing to pay extra on their electricity bill to share the costs of bringing the service out. And it's been kind of mixed in the answers and the results. For example, in one study, I remember there was a question about that. And so the utility started to expand. And when they expanded and started talking about an adder on the electricity bill, people suddenly got all excited about it. So it proved that while your survey may say that, the actual implementation may not be as real life there. So we wanted to make sure that those who would benefit from the broadband service would be the ones that would be actually paying for it, which is their vote, if you will, paying with their dollars that, yep, we want it. We're willing to pay for it. Here's my check that would come through the retailer. So seeing those experiences and also our gut feelings as to how our electrical customers would feel if there was an adder onto their electricity bill for it gave us that kind of weather vane to move us in that direction. And we did. And I think it's really interesting when you start taking a look at the Fiberhood project, which we'll discuss later, that people are voting with their dollars and their feet on this, that they want it, they're willing to pay for it, and will.
So, Joel, one of the things that we recently did an interview with Kitsap, where they are using a model where the people in a neighborhood can petition the utility to expand it. And I think you're going in a little different direction. Maybe you can explain that model and just enlighten us a little bit about that.
There are various funding models that are available through the public realm in Washington State to help fund facility expansion and growth. And most of those tend towards the local utility district, local improvement district type model. They're very, very intricate and cumbersome and take a long time to form and also to close out. One of the things that Kitsap has done, and I applaud them for that, is that some of their local utility district extensions have been in part of other utility extensions as well. So it's kind of a package of utilities that's moving into a community. So there's a greater benefit than just the broadband coming in, which makes it a little bit more easy to use those state funding models. Because one of the things that you run up against is if you do an improvement through a local utilities district or a local improvement district, the value of your property increase is the most that you can charge for an assessment for bringing that improvement to the property. So if the property improvement is $1,000 in valuation, that's all you can charge them under state law. And your extension could cost more than that per customer. So taking a look at not only the cumbersome nature of those funding measures, but also some of the legalistic restrictions that are placed on you on how you can assess it, that for a local utility district, just expanding broadband and no other public utilities as part of it, becomes a little bit of a problematic approach.
Justin, you want to just dive in and talk about how you've expanded?
We were looking at all of these different inputs and pieces of information, from our engineering standards to our customers' desire to the survey responses to the LUD models that some of our neighbors were using. And we decided that there had to be a way to blend all of this together and put it, create a solution that would be able to meet everybody's desire. And that birthed our Fiberhood program. And our Fiberhood program is really quite simple. The PUD has reviewed its service territory and has designated specific boundaries or borders. We have 20 on launch, and that represents the potential to serve several thousand customers. And within these Fiberhoods, we've let customers know that they are up for consideration of potentially receiving a fiber network being expanded to and built throughout their neighborhood. And we partnered with the COS Systems. COOS is what we've been calling it in-house. Systems are out of Sweden. And they have a fantastic software platform that we've been using to communicate and interface with our customers on this.
That's the Service Zones platform, right?
So our customers log on to our website, pud3.org/fiberhood, and they launched the COS Systems Service Zones application. And all they have to do is type in their address. If their address is within a Fiberhood, then they're able to make a commitment. And once 75% of the customers within the Fiberhood make a commitment, PUD3 will extend fiber and build a distribution network to serve them. It really is quite simple, and it's been very, very successful so far. As I mentioned, we have about 20 Fiberhoods. We launched it in early August, and we have several that are very, very close. One Fiberhood is about 7 signups away, and we have others on its tail. So Very excited about that process, and we're looking forward to launching that.
I'm curious, the ones that are the most popular, that are the closest to hitting fruition, are they ones that have zero service providers currently, or are they ones who are more, they have an option, but they're not happy with it?
We didn't qualify customers that have other service provider options in fiberhoods. And so really, if you're a fiberhood, you have a DSL or worse. And so these people are ones that don't have any high-speed broadband options available. We have several providers in Mason County, and we are staying out of their territory for several reasons. The first is we want to focus on those that don't have service, just like that public utility model in the beginning that we talked about. We want to make sure we're providing service to those that don't have it available. We also don't want to infringe upon or overbuild a private company. That's their deal, so they should be working on that. And we also don't want to expand a network very near them, in which case they would then overbuild us, and that's no good either. So we have our focus on customers that don't have other service options.
Some of my more aggressive listeners, and myself included, would say, well, I hope that over time you will be expanding your network to everyone. Presumably, it will be up to people themselves whether or not ultimately you are competing with some of the existing providers. Just in the sense that while I certainly agree with you that you want to be careful about respecting the private investments that others are making, to some extent, you may see some negative side effects if you have part areas that have a high quality network and areas that are served but served poorly by a cable company or something. They might get more frustrated. So, in the longer term, I'm curious if you think that you'll be expanding that network into more areas.
I would say that in the longer term is a long term for us. We have a very large and very rural community, county, Mason County, and there are many, many, many areas that do not have other options. So the work ahead of us is great, and we want to make sure that we are meeting the needs of those that don't have options before we meet the needs of those that do have options or maybe are receiving poor options. So while someday that may change, right now our focus really is on those that don't have options. And I think that that's just a look at Mason County. Our trees outnumber our people by a lot. And so we are quite rural here.
And it's worth remembering that Western counties can be the size of Eastern states. So
yeah, that is a good point. We are the size of Rhode Island, I believe. Is that correct, Joel?
That is correct.
Right. So there's some good perspective there.
That is correct. It's interesting to note when you take a look at the various municipal broadband models throughout the United States that there's a panoply of them. I mean, you've got cities who are given broad authorities by their states to provide a number of services for their citizens. And in Washington State, where the law is silent on an authority, it's assumed that a city or a county or a general government have the authority to do it. So that's why you see some cities going out and building municipal broadband networks on their own and competing as a retailer because they have authority under it. You have electric co-ops that can pretty do almost anything they want, going out as a retail service provider and using their member revenues to build that up. They are not under a state charter, so therefore they can do things like that. Whereas Washington State Public Utility District law is a little bit different. Whereas, as I mentioned with cities where it's silent on authorities, that they have it as long as it's legal, public utility districts only have the authorities that are expressly given to them under Washington state law. So if it doesn't mention it, we don't have the authority. So specifically, the authority we have is wholesale broadband services or telecommunications services that will always require a retailer as the contact with the customer. Our customers are initially the retail service providers, the ultimate customers of those retail service providers are the end users. And we have to make sure that model is followed very carefully, because it's being very, very closely watched, not only by the legislature and state regulators, but also folks who see this as competition.
One of the things that we've seen in a lot of places is that model is particularly challenging financially, which is one of the reasons that we've mentioned NOAANet, the Northwest Open Access Network, because you were one of the founding members. And I think the success of that organization is one of the reasons we've seen open access be more successful in Washington State than in other states.
I agree. I mean, the NOAANet has gained the capacity and the reputation of being a very good partner with people who either fund it or get service from it. And we're really proud of that because it's a unique type of organization. And I think that it will only continue as that reputation for a can-do-it attitude and good management of assets continues for NOAANet. It'll continue the expansion to very rural areas of Washington State.
Well, Justin, speaking of the expansion to rural areas, there's always the question of how one pays for it. So within this system that you've described with the service zones from COS, how exactly does it work that you can afford to build this out?
Add that to the challenges of being wholesale only. And as a public utility district, we have to do everything at cost. So there's not a profit margin here. Our revenues need to equal our costs, and that's to the benefit of our customer. So the way that it works is once a fiberhood reaches their 75% threshold, they make it on the construction list and we build the network. We have what we're calling a construction adder. This would be a $25 charge per month on top of the customer's internet retail service provider's bill. And this $25 per month is to recover the cost of building the fiber extension, the distribution network, and all the way to the home. So we're building all the way to the home with fiber. And this $25 per month will last for 12 years. So it is a 12-year term. And if a customer comes in and takes service on day one and we build to their home and connect them, they take internet service, then they pay that $25 per month. But maybe life happens 2 years down the road. They move or lose their job or life changes somehow. And they say, gosh, I just can't afford to have internet again or right now, then they don't take internet service and they don't pay that $25 per month. On the other side, let's say somebody maybe has a piece of property that they haven't developed yet, but they still are interested when they do move into the county to get fiber. They may sign up on the COS software and say, yes, I'm interested, but once they reach their goal and once we build the network, they're not ready to connect. Maybe 6 years down the road, they do show up and they build a home and want to connect it to fiber. Well, their $25 per month starts when they start taking service, and it only lasts until the end of that 12-year term that the fiberhood is under. So it really is tied to only the customers that are taking service are paying to help recover the cost of the investment. And I think we talked about that earlier. In the show, that was pretty important that we weren't having all electrical subscribers subsidize the cost of the fiber expansion. And even within the fiberhood, if you weren't interested in it, you didn't sign up for it, you're also not paying for it. I think that's a really key piece here.
I think one of the things that may help you out with that, where that may not be as viable in other areas, is that you are building to areas where they have no choices. And so you know that you're going to get a lot of people to connect. And so you don't really have to worry too much that those economics won't pencil out for you, I'm guessing.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. We are looking at a cost recovery model that is pretty conservative, and it lasts over a longer period of time. In these rural communities, what we often see is that there are lower economic abilities to pay for large line extensions up front. And so by spreading it out over that 12-year term, we're also allowing maybe some of our lower income or customers that couldn't afford that to be able to have access to high-speed broadband. I think that's a really key piece there too. For other listeners that might be interested, we looked at several models, many, but two of them that came to the front that we really explored were the putting a lien on a property for the investment. And we found that was just going to be too cumbersome, both legally and in enforcing. And the other was the personal loan. And we thought that also was very limiting in our ability. And so instead of tying the $25 to the customer's PUD electric bill, we decided to tie it to their internet service provider's bill. That way we could ensure that if you weren't taking service and therefore weren't benefiting from the network, you also weren't contributing to it. Our customers, I will say, in the survey, preferred it to be on the PUD's bill. I think it's because we're a trusted community partner. But we found that there were some struggles with that. If a customer didn't pay their internet bill, could we disconnect their electricity? No. If a customer didn't pay their electricity bill, could we disconnect their internet? Well, that really wasn't tied together. Maybe they didn't pay their internet extension payment, and so then we'd have to let their retail service provider know that we're going to have to disconnect them, and that would be exposing potentially, a personal hardship to the retail service provider, or that would get in the way of their business relationship, and so that was messy as well. And so we found that putting that $25 construction adder on top of the $35 per month for gig service, which goes to the retailer bill, it just became really clean and a really nice defining line on who's paying for what service.
It's a great description of an interesting approach, and one of many that I hope is going to bring high quality internet service to everyone in rural America. So thank you both for coming on the show to tell us more about what you're up to.
Happy to do it, Chris. And that's really great of you to invite us, and we'd love to tell the story. We're really proud of it. And we're also in agreement, if everybody in Mason County could have a gig up, gig down service through PUD3 fiber, that'd just be fantastic.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Christopher with Justin Holsgrove and Joel Meyer talking about Public Utility District 3 in Washington and how they're bringing high-quality connectivity to every customer in Mason County. We have transcripts for this and other Community Broadband Bits podcasts available at muninetworks.org/broadbandbits. Email us at podcast@muninetworks.org with your ideas for the show. Follow Chris on Twitter. His handle is @CommunityNets. Follow muninetworks.org stories on Twitter. The handle is @MuniNetworks. Subscribe to this podcast and the other ILSR podcasts, Building Local Power and the Local Energy Rules podcast. You can access them on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Never miss out on our original research by also subscribing to our monthly newsletter at ilsr.org. Thank you to Arnie Huseby for the song Warm Duck Shuffle, licensed through Creative Commons, and thanks for listening to episode 274 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast.